You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how small-scale violence against a targeted group can become genocidal. What we can learn from the three forgotten genocides. But first, we continue our discussion with preeminent psychology scholar Irvin Staub about building peaceful and altruistic communities.
Last week, we spoke with psychology scholar Irvin Staub about how to build peaceful societies, particularly when some groups have been traumatized by violence, war, or genocide. This is part two of our discussion.
Our next guest has long studied the roots of violence, genocide, and other destructive acts. His work then turned to the roots of what he called goodness, when people rescue one another, even at the risk of their own lives. And with that, he has turned to how we can establish societies that are built on altruism and moral courage. Irvin Staub joins us now. His latest book is called The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Irvin Staub. It's great to have you back with us.
It's very nice to speak to you again.
As you pointed out in your book, a lot of times as societies become more violent or more punishing, it's progressive. So it starts by looking down at people, and it could get progressively worse for them.
I think that a core principle about many things, but both about violence and about caring and helping, is what I call learning by doing. That is, we change as a result of our own actions. When we harm someone, whether an individual or a group, and there are no contrary influences that would stop us, then we justify what we do. We justify it by seeing the other in a negative light, by deserving of the harm. We see our actions as moral for various reasons. There is a kind of a reversal of morality. In group violence, in genocide, there is a reversal of morality, so that killing that originally was seen by most people as unacceptable and bad becomes the right thing to do in relation to these people. So there is this evolution. Now, fortunately, I think that a similar evolution can happen when people do positive things for others, when people help others. This happens in many settings and many circumstances, this positive evolution. I have done research with young children in which we had children make toys for poor hospitalized children, or older children teach younger children, and also some other ways that we got older kids to help. And what we found was that they became more helpful as a result. That at a later time, they were more likely to help than other children whom we also engaged in various activities, in similar activities, but not activities that helped somebody else. Like they made toys, but not for poor hospitalized children. Also, so-called rescuers, people in Europe under Nazi rule who endangered themselves and often their families and their children also, in order to save the lives of people, Jews, designated for death. These people sometimes started out in response to somebody asking them or in response to knowing somebody's need by deciding to hide one person in their attic, in a back room, in a basement, you know, somewhere for a short period of time. And then they got committed. They continued to hide that person. They may have taken in other people. If they succeeded in moving these people to a safer place, some of these people then begin to look around to see in what other ways they could help. So people change as a result of their actions. And that's very important in promoting helpful and caring people and good societies.
So can this happen in reverse after it's occurred in one direction? Say, for example, and you've discussed this in your book, I've studied it in some of my work, how, yes, people who are involved in genocidal behavior or wars or torture, they believe the ends justify the means. They think they're doing something good in their minds, therefore they continue to do it and feel good about themselves. Can people who have engaged in that kind of behavior then progress in the other direction through this learning by doing?
Well, that's a really good question, and we don't really have an answer to that because we don't have either research or many examples of people who have been perpetrators of great harm then beginning to engage in positive actions and changing as a result. Now, we know examples, some few instances, when people who have done great harm then at some point realize the terrible things that they have done and they try to make up for it. But we don't have any systematic information about it. Now, I do think that it is possible for this to happen. You know, when things come to an end and when people are helped, people who have done terrible things are helped by people around them to heal from their own actions. Because doing terrible things to other people, killing people, doing great harm is also wounding. It affects who people are, it creates psychological damage, and if people are helped to heal and over time come to see the terrible things that they have done, I think it is possible for them to begin to move in another direction. But another important thing is what I call altruism born of suffering. Now, most of the research on how caring and helping and altruism develops has focused on what I call positive socialization, experiences of warmth and affection, of guidance by good values, of firm discipline but not harsh, not punitive discipline, of learning by doing when children are helped to engage in positive behaviors. And this has been mostly the focus of how caring and helpful behavior and this feeling of responsibility and empathy develop. But the research on people who were harmed, who have suffered, who were victimized, has focused for a long time on how they either withdraw from people, they develop psychological problems, or they become hostile and aggressive. And it is true, I think, that one of the characteristics of societies, one of the varied influences on societies that may begin to move towards genocide, is that the group has been victimized, harmed, and wounded in the past. However, at some point, I realized that some people who have been greatly harmed become caring and altruistic and want to prevent harm to other people or want to help people who have harmed. You know, I published a questionnaire in Psychology Today a long time ago on values of helping, and 7,000 people returned it, and many of them, in response to my request, wrote letters accompanying the questionnaire. And some of the people wrote in their letters, I want to help others because the way I suffered or the way I was harmed. So I began to look at this and I began to study this. And then one of my students and I did some research on it too. And it does seem to be the case that people who have been harmed, some of them, I believe especially if they had certain experiences, start to care about other people, help other people, concerned about others' welfare, and their own experience of suffering becomes now a motivator not to turn against others, but to turn towards others and to help others. And this is very important because so many people suffer in so many ways in the world. And if all those people turned against others, we would have a world that's very problematic, even more problematic than the world that we have.
Do you think that societies that start to develop norms, which are more harmful norms, more competitive norms, do you think that these are born of a particular type of harm that has been done? So there was one of the studies you cited in here had to do with people who were attached in various ways, avoidantly aggressive, anxiously attached, securely attached. I mean, do you think that the personal then, you know, ripples out into the societal, or do you think it goes the other way, or both?
I think that it's true that there is research that shows that children who are avoidantly attached, associated...
I just wanted you to define that for those of us who are not psychologists.
It's a particular way that it is measured. But, you know, the way that it is measured is that at some point, a child is in a room and a parent leaves the room and comes back. And these are very young children. And most of the time when the parent leaves the room, the child is distressed. And when the parent comes back, then the child can behave in a variety of different ways. So avoidantly attached children are less distressed when the mother leaves, and they don't pay much attention to the mother when the mother comes back. That's the measurement of it. And the source of it seems to be not as caring and responsive, not as responsive caretaking of the child as, for example, with a securely attached child. There is more distance, there is less response to the child's needs, so the child becomes kind of independent, more independent, and the researchers who studied attachment call it avoidant. So children, in addition to being raised by parents who are somewhat distant and not as caretaking, can also be raised by punitive parents. And in a whole society, there can be norms that develop where child rearing is punitive. You know, if you look, for example, at books that tell parents how to raise children in the 19th century in Germany, but also in England, and some of it in the United States, they would tell parents to make sure that the child doesn't get his or her way, that the child is obedient, and that the child will be punished when the child is willful, and the punishment can take any and all kinds of forms. So if a whole society develops a practice of raising children that way, I think that the underlying feeling in the child about other people will be that others are dangerous. And rather than feeling warmth and affection, there will be a feeling of either avoidance or hostility. And so, depending on circumstances, this child may be obedient, follow authorities, which can lead to a problem if the authorities lead in the wrong direction, and under other circumstances that allow hostility, the child may become hostile, or the person the child grows into may be hostile and may be violent. So, yes, norms can develop in a society in which children are raised in such a way that hostility and aggression by them becomes more likely. And the opposite can also be true.
And in your final chapter, of course, you're talking about building societies that are altruistic and people actually caring about each other and taking care of one another. If this is what you're up against, what can one do to start to develop this in such a society?
It's not the case, I think, that this is not a widespread norm in this society. I think that parents in the United States are quite variable, and many of them realize that raising a child with love and affection is to the benefit of the child, to the benefit to themselves, is to the benefit of everyone. Now, not everybody realizes this. And unfortunately, another issue is that many people live under very stressful circumstances of poverty, of discrimination, and of various issues. And these create frustrations and these create difficulties. We know, for example, that when somebody becomes unemployed, this person becomes more negative in his or her behavior towards other people in the family. It's just the frustration, the sense of identity, how it is affected, and so on. So the challenge is that in order to raise children in the way that they become caring people, who is going to raise them that way? Well, the adults have to understand and have to develop the skills, and most importantly, have to develop the inclinations to do what is required to raise caring children. So it's not only the adults in the home, it's also adults in the schools. The schools can do a tremendous amount to make a difference. How do we do this? Well, it's not easy, but one of the things that we could do really is to provide training to people. You know, a long time ago, I had the idea of creating caring classrooms, caring schools, when the school environment and the classroom are so developed that children feel cared about, that they have responsibilities, that they can do things for the welfare of others and to benefit others and so on, so that it all contributes to their caring for other people. And I also thought that in connection with this, you could get the parents involved. Now, in environments where there is a lot of disorder and poverty and so on, it is difficult to get the parents involved. But the schools have a potential to do that. They can create events where the children do things that is of interest to the parents, whether it is art, whether it's music, whether it is something intellectual and so on, and get the parents involved and provide the parents some kind of education as to how to raise caring children. Now, some of this happens from a very early age on. People have done research on this, and the practices have been introduced for parents, especially single women, who, when they are in the hospital about to deliver a baby, somebody comes and supports them and comes to the home and helps them with various agencies and shows them how to care for the child and does various things that are likely to contribute to more positive parenting. And research shows that this has a significant effect. So we have done trainings for people in Rwanda. We have created educational radio programs for people to help understand the origins of violence between groups and ways to go about preventing violence and reconciliation. And these programs have an impact. You know, we can do things here in the United States also to provide education that people can apply to their own experience. So what happens is not only that they have some information, but they have what I call an experiential understanding that then can begin to guide their behavior.
Well, let's go back to Rwanda for just a moment. I know you've done quite a bit of work there and in Burundi, and I think you also did some work in Congo with some of the survivors of genocide. And you've studied the bystanders there that helped rescue people, the ones that survived. And you were essentially helping these survivors to also go through a healing process, which from what I have been studying in your work and others, is what could help prevent a reverse retaliatory violence from occurring. One of the things that you wrote about in the book is that people who have survived a genocide or a violent war, they have particular needs to prevent them from wanting to seek revenge. Or how can this be reconciled for people who have suffered these great traumas? For example, having their suffering acknowledged. Perpetrators don't want to acknowledge a suffering.
Let me take a small detour in getting there, and that is that I think that crucial to our human lives and how we are in the world is that we all have, in addition to material needs, core psychological needs. Everybody has a need for feeling secure. Everybody has a need for feeling effective so that we can influence important things in our lives. Everybody has a need for a positive identity. Everybody has a need to understand the world and our place in it. And all of these needs are deeply frustrated when people are victimized. You come to feel vulnerable, to see the world as dangerous. At the time when you are harmed, you feel ineffective. You feel that you cannot control events. Your understanding of the world changes. We have a deep feeling of needing connection to other people, and we are disconnected because there we are, victims, harmed. If these needs are not fulfilled constructively, people will fulfill them destructively. they will gain a feeling of effectiveness by violence, and so on. So we need to help people to heal, and some of this involves trying to help satisfy these needs. So circumstances that provide some degree of security is very important in order to be able to do other things. But that doesn't mean that you cannot begin to heal when circumstances are somewhat insecure, because rarely are they completely secure. But when they are very insecure, everything is disorganized, there is great danger, then it becomes difficult to begin to heal. Now, what do people need for healing? One of the things that they need is an acknowledgement of their suffering. They need other people to acknowledge what happened to them. Ideally, the perpetrators will acknowledge what happened to them. That's very difficult because perpetrators often withhold acknowledgement. They deny their responsibility. So other people, the rest of the world, can acknowledge. People need to get in touch with their experiences and look at them and experience their experiences so that they see that the current situation is different from the time when these bad things happened to them. How do people get in touch with their experiences? Well, one way is for survivors of violence to come together and to give testimony, to talk about their experience and talk about what happened to them. And so that is a contributor to healing. And this happens in the company of other people who understand it, who are sympathetic, who support you. And other thing that can happen is commemoration, where in some way you create ceremonies that remember, commemorate what happened. Now, with commemorations, usually what people do is they focus very intensely on the terrible events that have happened. And I think that for commemoration to contribute to a better future and to healing, people have to progressively begin to also consider a better future, how what happened can change into something different, how the world can be different to move towards something positive. And there is a time element here, a time dimension. People who just suffered cannot begin to look at this future in a positive way. They have to engage with what happened. But over time, this can change. And another thing that can happen is that increasingly it may become possible for people to commemorate the terrible things with outsiders. First, maybe with outsiders who are sympathetic third group. But then over time, people who did the harm and people who were harmed may also begin to do commemorations together. Now, that requires also, of course, for those who did the harm to acknowledge the harm that they have done. So when that doesn't happen, when that is denied, then the victims are not likely to be open to join with perpetrators, with former perpetrators. But it doesn't even have to be perpetrators themselves. It can be members of the perpetrator group who were passive bystanders and who now acknowledge what has happened and see what has happened and join in commemoration. So these are some of the elements. I mean, another thing that people who have been victimized need desperately is some sense of justice. When there is some degree of justice in the form of some punishment, at least of the major perpetrators, in the form of some limited compensation at least, which is a form of acknowledgement also, then people can come to feel that the world says what was done was not right and we are trying to create a different world. So these are all elements, pieces of what can contribute to both healing and reconciliation.
So we've gone from the micro to the macro, from individuals and child rearing and active bystanders to global issues.
Well, you know, it goes back to the active bystander. It goes back to every person in every position, a parent, a teacher, a school official, an administrator in whatever positions, whether it's in the IRS or somebody working for a bank, as a clerk or as a president, to members of our government at every level, if everybody asked himself or herself, how can I be active in a positive way to make this a better world? And also, how can I shift away from thinking primarily in ideological terms, because we in the United States have such divergent ideologies, to think less in abstractions, to think in terms of more concrete benefit to human beings and to every human being within our society. And if I have responsibilities that involve relations with other countries, also in the rest of the world. So shift away from abstractions, think about concrete human welfare, and think about how, with some actions at least, I can contribute to that. And if we engaged in that kind of thinking and orientation, and we took some actions, that would make a huge difference. And, you know, we don't have to be experts in order to bring our expertise to some issue. My next project is, I was asked by a foundation to come to Kalamazoo and use my past work, working with people there, to try to address gang violence in Chicago and in Kalamazoo. I am not an expert on gang violence, but I know a few things that may be relevant. But other people who are involved with it may be able to use some of what I know in order to apply it to their own situation. So what I am saying is that we can work in various settings, bringing whatever knowledge, whatever determination, whatever willingness, whatever heart we have to try to affect things to create a better society and a better world.
Well, Irvin Staub, the new book again is called The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership and Heroism. Thank you so much for being with us again here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much.
What we can learn from the three forgotten genocides.
Stay tuned.
Birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guests participated in a standing room only live forum that explored the roots of violence and genocide, what they have in common, and what it takes to prevent and to heal in their aftermaths. Our experts are University of Auckland Political Studies lecturer Chris Wilson, sociology professor Tracy McIntosh, and University of Technology lecturer Panayotis Diamandis. I think we'll start, Panayotis Diamandis, with you to talk about the three peoples who were targeted at this particular time, why it occurred, and what actually happened.
Thank you for the invitation. I think that the reasons for why the genocides happened were covered in the video quite succinctly. One thing it doesn't cover is that this was a campaign against all Gyavur, all infidels, the Yazidis, all different branches of the Assyrians, so the Syriac Orthodox, the Church of the East, the Syriac Catholics, the Chaldean Catholics, all of them. And of course my own people, the Hellenes or the Greeks. This was a campaign to Turkify, to start by Islamizing the empire, whatever territories they could retain. And phase two was to eliminate Kurdish identity and Turkify everybody. The few small communities in the major cities were to be tolerated, but not in any great proportions, not in any great numbers serious enough to threaten control of the state. And make no bones about it, make no mistake, this is all about power. As it quite succinctly said there at the beginning after Sadiq Hamish, this was a campaign against minority groups. By the way, nobody was majority of the Ottoman Empire. There were majorities in particular districts, but overall, no one group had a majority of the population. Before the Balkan Wars, I would say the split was roughly 60% Muslim across the empire, 40% Christian. And that includes very heavily Muslim areas like Syria, what is now Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel / Palestine. The campaigns actually began straight after the Balkans Wars. So this is early 1913, coming into the beginning of 1914. Campaigns started in the western part of the empire, particularly in a region that I know as Thrace. You guys know it as Gallipoli. Some of the earliest expulsions, deportations, were of the Greeks of Gallipoli. And by the way, there was an Armenian church in Gallipoli, in the town of Gallipoli. And this is one thing, particularly this year in 2015, that we need to remind anybody associated with ANZAC, that we are talking about the native peoples, the indigenous peoples of these areas. They were there first. Now, some people may consider that a controversial statement to make, but that's the reality. My people have been on the western shores, the eastern shores of the Aegean and on the Black Sea coast for about 4,000 years. The Armenians and the Assyrians have a presence there even older than that in their parts of the region. So the connection to Gallipoli is not just dates. Some of the earliest victims of the genocide were the Armenian community of Gallipoli town. Why? Because it controls access to the imperial capital, Constantinople. The guy who came up with the idea of cleansing all the infidels from the backyard of the imperial capital was not Mustafa Kemal. I refuse to use the name that they used in the film. His honorific title. His mother named him Mustafa. His nickname was Kemal, so that's the end of the story. His name was Mustafa Kemal, who wasn't a Turk, by the way. His father was Albanian, his mother was Greek. Islamized, but her first language at home was Greek. We have accounts from Greek prisoners of war that she would interview because they were from her hometowns in what we now call Western Macedonia, so Florina Kastoria, for those of you who know Greece. And his father was an Albanian, minor tax official. The real guy at Gallipoli, who was in charge of Gallipoli, was a guy called Limon von Sanders. Yes, German. And he writes in his own memoir about the time, I'm the one who said that we cannot have a hostile population. Listen to that word, hostile population in the backyard of the empire. So you have the expulsions and deportations happening from 1913, 1914. By the time the war begins in August of 1914, you've got 300,000 refugees in Greece. The war hasn't started, and you've already got 300,000 people expelled. Literally, in 24 hours, pack whatever you can carry and be gone. Otherwise, we will kill you. The ones who didn't believe it were killed. And we've got all sorts of documentary. The role of journalists was supreme, not only in causing it, but also in documenting what was happening. Now, one of the newspaper items that they showed up there mentioned a town called Karahisar. And I love the ambassador's comment there about, oh, the deportations were only in the eastern part of the empire because it was a war zone and, you know, things happened, we wanted to evacuate them. Karahisar was about 1,500 kilometres from the nearest war zone. It's about 1,500 kilometres from Gallipoli. It's in the western part of Anatolia. It's a major railway junction. Ah, railways. Come back to that in a minute. The parallels with the Shoah, with the Holocaust, are staggering and are only now beginning to be really, really examined. Before I go on another rant. Karahisar. Today it's called Afyon Karahisar, is how you'll find it on maps and on Google. It was a POW camp. There were a number of houses, a whole neighbourhood, and a particular building in this town. The remnants of the building and the houses are still there. We've got photos of them, footage of them. This is where ANZACs were held prisoner. ANZACs captured at Gallipoli. Now, hands up, who actually knew we had ANZAC POWs in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, in 1915. Three. At least 25 of them were Kiwis. I'm having a dispute now with some other scholars, but it's between 250 and 300 were Australian. A number of them were here, in this town called Afion. The church was Our Lady Mother of God, Armenian Apostolic Church of Afion. That was their prison camp. The altar areas where the offices were, because it was most sheltered from the winds. The closer you were to the door, the lower your rank. So the privates basically got exposed to the worst of the cold and the worst of the heat. We have their diaries, the ones who survived, because a third of them didn't survive. We have their diaries saying, this is what the locals told us. We have diaries from one Victorian guy, an Australian called Luscombe. You can Google all these names, all this stuff. It's all on the internet now. I love the internet. Talking about the deportation train of Armenian women and children at Afion. An Anzac witnessing the deportations, 1,500 kilometres from the nearest battlefront. We have another Australian who later became a minister in the Menzies government, for those of you who know much about Australian history. A guy called Thomas Walter White. He was a pilot. He was shot down near a place called Azizia. It's north of Basra in today's Iraq. He was marched up through Mosul. These places sound familiar to some of you? Yeah? Across north of Deir Ezzor, but to Ras El Ain, and then over the Taurus Mountains, past a place called Birachik. That's why I mentioned it. While they're crossing the mountains, he writes, I saw a deportation column going the other way. And we know where they'd passed through because there were dead bodies and bones all along the route that we walked across in the other direction. He stopped at north of Mosul at a town called Tel Armin and talks about nothing but dogs being left alive there. The locals were quite proud of it, of what had happened. Yeah, we cleaned them out. Now, I've been informed that there is a recognition campaign in New Zealand. We need somebody to go to either to the National Archives. I'm not sure whether they're in Wellington or Auckland. Go to the War Memorial, because all this stuff I've told you about the POWs is in the War Memorial in Canberra. The originals are still there. This is not me making stuff up. You can actually go. I can give you the file numbers. You can go and look at the originals. These are 100-year-old documents now. There were Kiwis there. There were Kiwis involved in the relief effort. The women, Jakobsen, Maria Jakobsen, the women that were bought, they were bought out of captivity, particularly from Kurdish, but also from Arab tribes. Where'd the money come from to buy these women out of captivity? Basically ransomed. Australia and New Zealand were big contributors. When Smydney was destroyed in September of 1922, Australia donated $100,000, $1922 dollars, tens of millions in today's currency, in relief. We succeeded in getting two of our six states in Australia, because we're a federation, like the US, to officially recognise, to adopt motions of recognition. The reason we achieved this is because, one, the three communities have worked together. They have pushed their local members, convinced them, basically, that this deserves recognition and that it is historical fact. Two, we convinced them that it's Australian history. If you look at the actual resolutions, because it's Australian history, it's now mine, so therefore I've got to recognise it. This is how it will happen in New Zealand as well. We have to make all three genocides New Zealand history, and then we'll succeed.
Thank you, Paniotis. Chris Wilson, specialist in conflict, war and genocide and terrorism. Can you put this into context for us?
I'll try and do so. What I'm going to try and do is talk about these sort of killings in the contemporary context. The best way to commemorate or to remember the victims of the genocide against the Armenians and Holocaust and other genocides and mass killings in history is to try and prevent it happening again. So that's what I'm going to try and talk about the contemporary situation at the moment. It's not a particularly positive talk, I guess. It's a rather pessimistic talk that has something to do with my personality. Also has something to do with having done about 12 years of field work in violent conflict zones, most recently about 3 months ago, and coming back and seeing things that were on a much, much smaller scale, of course. And so this is not to try and belittle something like the Armenian genocide or the Holocaust, but to point to the fact that there are, and I'm going to come back to this, I'm going to make an argument, there are things like this happening on a smaller scale, in some cases, you know, not that much smaller at the moment, that are not being referred to at the moment. So that's something I want to move to. And I'm going to do so with reference to what seems to be a growing orthodoxy at the moment, that we're living in a particularly peaceful era. the long peace. It's referred to the 70 years since World War II. People are starting to say, you know, we've finally made it. The principles of the Enlightenment have come to fruition, and we've put all the stuff behind us. So I just want to make a few points that I think that's perhaps misguided. And it rests on a little bit of a focus on perhaps Europe and the West and missing what's happening in developing regions of the world. I just want to start off by saying a few points on the study of genocide and some of the commonalities. Obviously, there's been quite a few genocides now over the past century. And so social science scholars, political scientists will try and look for commonalities in these genocides to try and understand them. Many of them are structural factors, and this is not to take away the human agency from them and therefore to take away the blame from those who are responsible for them, but to point to some of the common structural factors or conditions. There are a number of common factors that have been seen across most of the genocides, the important genocides of the last 100 years. Perhaps one of them, which is growing into an orthodoxy and seems to be reasonably solid, although I thought so until 5 minutes ago, is the correlation with war. Most scholars would now point to the genocide. There is a strong connection between genocide and war. Most of the major genocides of the past 100 years have occurred within the context of war. The Armenian genocide in World War I, the Holocaust in World War II, the Rwandan genocide in the context of a civil war between Hutus and Tutsis, the Cambodian genocide, ideological genocides like the Cambodian genocide, which occurred in the context of the wars in French Indochina and the series of wars there, even the ideological genocide in Indonesia in 1965 and 66, in the context of the Cold War, if you like. Why is this the case? Some of the arguments are that in a context of war, society becomes more militarized, weapons are more prevalent, people are more nationalistic, nationalism starts to rise, but also people are more amenable to follow orders, people are more susceptible to authority and not question authority. There are a number of reasons why there does seem to be this correlation between genocide and war. So another way of framing this question of, is genocide likely to happen again or can it happen again, is to change the question around a little bit. Is it possible that there's going to be a war, a major war, that will allow this type of genocide to occur again? Because it does, as I say, it does seem to be in that context. Now, this brings me to this growing consensus. It seems to be that we are living in a particularly peaceful era. This is most prominently and recently associated with a psychologist from Harvard known as Steven Pinker, who has released a book recently, which is a bestseller. And of course, there's always a bit of academic jealousy when an academic releases a book that's a bestseller. But it makes the argument, it's called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And it makes the argument that since the Enlightenment, since the late 1700s, the 1800s, there have been these principles of reason, growing reason, of growing tolerance, that ideas that war is irrational. And these have been growing since the 1800s, and war has been declining ever since. Now, according to Pinker, the catastrophes that we are looking at, we just watched a movie about and we've been hearing about, and the Holocaust and other catastrophes like we've seen in the first half of the 20th century, according to Pinker, were a blip, not to be too silly about it, but are seen as a bit of a backlash against these Enlightenment ideals that are progressing. And this is a counter-Enlightenment backlash. But according to Pinker, these were rather contingent events and could be pretty much, talking about the Holocaust and World War II, could be pretty much summarized in the small statement, no Hitler, no war, and no Holocaust. There were contingent events that were led by individuals and so on. And according to Pinker, we have gone back, since World War II, we've gone back to this progress of Enlightenment ideals, and that's why we've seen 70 years of no major war. And this is not a fluke. It's because of these progress from the Enlightenment ideals, and it's basically been summarised as moral progress. Now, my argument is that this growing consensus makes this era particularly dangerous. This makes it particularly dangerous to another event like this happening, when people become very, very confident that these forces have gone and we don't have to worry about them anymore. Because I would argue that they have not gone. Enlightenment ideals, positive liberal Enlightenment ideals, have always been in constant contestation with nationalism, with the sort of ideals that we saw in the movie and that we're thinking about in terms of these genocides. There's a constant contestation and they have not gone away. And again, this is something that I've seen in my fieldwork in many areas, that there are these forms of nationalism wax and wane and become very strong depending on political institutions, depending on political context, and depending on the paranoia of power, if you like. There are things that bring these forces of nationalism back to the fore, and in many places they are right at the fore of what's happening. And this is another problem with this growing consensus, is that it's very much focused on the developed world and forgets what's happening in the developing world. And in many areas of the developing world, life is still very brutish and short, to paraphrase Hobbes. So this is one of the main problems for me, is that it ignores what's happening in many areas of the world in which many people are still dying because of their identity. And I know this because just a few months ago I left my last period of field work where several hundred people had been killed just because of their ethno-religious identity, and I left the field and came back to here to continue teaching, very, very concerned that more was likely to happen. Within a week of coming back, another 40 people had been massacred. And these are state-led, these are massacres by political leaders. As I say, these are much, much smaller events than what we're looking at here. But within each of these, and there are thousands of them occurring simultaneously as we speak, and within each of these there are the seeds of terrible events like the ones that we're thinking of. There are the seeds of genocide. I'm going to leave it there in terms of that point. I just want to make one other point, and this is to bring it down right from that very macro point down to a much more micro point, and that is the question of who is it who commits these genocides? And can you and I commit them? I mean, this is the question that's always interested me, and because it's always quite reassuring to think that these genocides are committed by people who are psychotic, sadistic, who are somehow abnormal and outside the norm. But studies have, time and time again, have proved that this is not the case. In the Holocaust, in Tarahumwe, in Rwanda, these are normal people who have families, engage in charitable work, who have very normal lives, but then somehow become genocidal, become engaged in genocide. I'll come back to why I'm making this point. It's very much normal people. So how is it that people like you and I can end up committing these genocides and these mass killings? And I'm sorry, I don't mean to drag you into my own obsession with how can normal people do it, but it is an important question, and I just want to pose two quick arguments before I finish. There are a number of arguments in how people like us can end up committing these types of genocides, because this is something that we need to keep in mind, because the danger is always there, and ordinary society can quickly move towards a genocidal society, and we need to keep that in mind. The first argument is what is known as gradualism. And that is very much to do with prejudice. And so the argument is that it's not one major leap from lives like ours into genocide. It's tiny little steps of escalating steps of prejudice. We start off thinking of another people from another community, another ethnic community, as somehow all the same, not looking at them as individuals. And then we start making jokes about them, and we start avoiding them. And then we start thinking, perhaps, electing leaders who are more discriminatory and start enacting laws that take away their rights, and then we start telling the authorities that that's where they live, and then soon enough we're engaging in violence, and the most horrific violence that you can imagine. So that, in one leap, that seems totally unbelievable, but each of those steps is not that inconceivable by themselves, and so that's something we need to keep in mind, as I said before. The second argument is this question of authority, and people are prone to following authority, particularly when it's seen as legitimate. The Milgram experiments, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, have shown that ordinary people are willing to cause terrible pain, perhaps even death, as long as they believe that they are following orders of a legitimate authority. In the Milgram experiments, people were asked by a scientist to ask questions of a person who was an actor in another room, in another cubicle, and if they got it wrong, they would give them an electric shock. And each time they got it wrong, they would turn the voltage up, and some people would say, I'm not that comfortable with this, and then the scientist would say, please continue, and they would keep going. And it showed that the vast majority of people were willing to go almost all the way to the end. 65% of people went all the way to the maximum voltage, which was known as fatal. And so they were hearing screams from the other side, and then with the top voltage, it went silent, and 65% of people were willing to do that. So it's something that needs to be kept in mind, and I just want to make those points because these are, in terms of policy prescriptions, these are things to keep these questions of small pieces of prejudice and the way we think of other groups, and also not wanting to be too much of a radical, but perhaps to rebel against authority when it is asking you to do terrible things to the marginalised. Thank you. I'll leave it there.
Tracy McIntosh.
Kia ora hui hui mai tato, kia ora koutou kato. It's a real honour for me to be here. I want to acknowledge the people that are here and recognise as a Māori woman that dead are always amongst us. There's a whole lot of things that I want to think about in terms of my own sort of work around genocide. And in 1984, well, in the early 80s, I lived in Burundi and Rwanda. So 10 years prior to the genocide of Rwanda. I want to position that, I guess, in speaking to both of you and speaking to what we have seen today. And I'm really wanting to put that in terms of, you know, if I'm thinking about Steven Pinker's timeline, that timeline absolutely aligns with some of the most massive forms of violence in terms of the colonization period. And recognizing, you know, as you noted in terms of the Amerindian, the genocide, the fact that Australia has largely been founded on near successful and sometimes successful genocides, repeated forms of genocide, that in New Zealand, whilst violence was largely used as a way to pacify people, and again we saw that in the film, that there were genocidal acts. But in speaking of that, I'm wanting to really sort of focus about a number of things. If we think about 10 years before the Armenian genocide and think about the genocide of the Herero people in Southwest Africa and present-day Namibia, where there we can see systematic, structural elimination, well, attempted elimination of a people, and that the people who were involved, the perpetrators of that genocide, it's particularly the young soldiers, young German soldiers, 18, 20, 22, if you saw the names of some of those soldiers, who were very young men at the time, their names would be familiar to you, because one of them went on to be the commander of Auschwitz, others became leading members in the Gestapo, that they did their training in the colonial grounds. And you know, the Herero people, the silence that we have around the Armenian and the Hellenic Assyrian genocides is certainly amplified, that silence is amplified by the silence around the genocide of the Herero people in 1905. In Southwest Africa as a part of a colonial form. So there's a real sort of, you know, again, around those silences, I'm wanting just to focus in the very short time that I have with you around some of these narratives of genocide. And it really came out strong, and like you, Chris, very interested around legitimacy and interrogation of legitimating strategies that we see as a constant sort of focus within genocidal narratives. So we have the narratives of the survivors. And these are incredibly important, you know, their testimony, their witnessing. That when the witnessing, the diaries that you speak about become more important than the action, that the diary survives, that the testimony survives, that the witnessing survives, even if those that have witnessed it do not survive, becomes more important. And we see, certainly in terms of the Holocaust in Rwanda, and where that becomes, you know, what will happen if the diary doesn't survive. You know, you actually have people speaking about that all the time. Their own lives have become secondary because it's the witnessing that is important. And in many ways, what we get with the narratives of survivors, even those who do not survive, is this absolute articulation of the experiential reality, which again, of the film that we've seen today, just, you know, how important that is, how searing that is in regards to teaching us as a learning space around our own humanity and our own inhumanity. The articulating of the unimaginable, that often at the reach of genocide, you know, one of the, you know, Samantha Powell and others have argued, Olga Clenodin has argued the same thing, that in many ways, when we're faced with it, it's unimaginable. And so to deny it for some becomes easier. That we can see these as these aberrant acts, these, you know, aberrations that have occurred, but this was not systemic, you know, there's no systemic structural forces in play. But that's one of the things that's really struck me in my work, is the incredible power of the imagination. These things were imagined and they were implemented. The narratives of perpetrators, I think, is where we get the most clearest strategies, and again, we've seen witness of that tonight, of descendants of perpetrators, at least, in terms of the need for real legitimating strategies. It occurred in times of conflict. Everyone was at war. You know, there was no, I mean, someone said that, you know, you must, well, he said it in the UN, no less, you must be totally innocent. This notion around innocence is that one can only be the entirely vulnerable, completely innocent to actually be a legitimate victim of atrocity, of abuse, of genocide. And so there are these narratives of perpetrators, that they recognize that their attempts to colonize the future and the way that we think about things, the way we understand things, the way we make sense of things, has been undermined by these other strategies coming up. And I think that that's particularly in what we saw tonight, that sort of sense of that need to control history, to control what is said in history, so that they can colonize the future in terms of the way that we look back and we think. You know, it is very interesting about what we remember and what we forget. France has put up a memorial to the Armenian genocide. They're not so keen on memorials around Algeria. And I think the last sort of things that I want to think about the narratives of silence, and I think that these play in two ways. We have the narratives of silent of those who could have said something but didn't, and we look to international communities, we look to individuals, we look to a whole range of people where they are the bystanders and the collective bystanders, and I absolutely agree that do we recognize today when genocide is occurring? Are we open to it? Do we want to see it? Do we want to see it happening very close to us, West Papua and other places where you have genocidal acts that are occurring? Do we recognize genocide? Is genocide something that we only ever see in looking back? Can we never recognize it when it's in front of us? We know that in terms of the Rwandan genocide, you know, an absolute memo was put forward. Do not mention genocide. Use the word genocidal act if you have to. Do not use the word genocide, because if you use the word genocide, then under the convention you have to act. Be careful when you use the word genocide. And the last narrative is the narratives of those that are silenced, where they have not survived. And in many cases there are no traces that have survived at all. And so we recognize that there are those that have been killed through in genocide that we do not remember, that they are silenced. And I think that's an important one.
Our guests participated in a standing room only live forum that explored the roots of violence and genocide, what they have in common, and what it takes to prevent and to heal in their aftermaths. Our experts are University of Auckland Political Studies lecturer Chris Wilson, sociology professor Tracy McIntosh, and University of Technology lecturer Panayotis Diamandis.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.